Hello and welcome to the Keeper Cup podcast. Chad Young and Pete Ball with you. We are through the start of the year. It is officially 2026. Keeper deadlines are upon us. I think for one of our listener leagues, we're recording this on Saturday. I think one of our listener leagues, the keeper deadline is Monday, right?
I don't know. I've had my keepers. I always like select my keepers of who I know I want to keep. And then if I make any trades or anything, I adjust it. So I don't really pay too close attention to keeper league keeper deadlines, but that sounds about right. I noticed the Discord has been buzzing.
Yeah, there's been a lot going on. So we'll have to see if any of that lands anything. I had a trade talk I thought might land somewhere. I'm waiting on it now. But that's for the other league, which I think we have an extra week on. So we'll see. But I'm figuring out. I made some. My dynasty leagues are starting to get a little bit more active. There's a lot going on right now. So
nice. See
more activity coming up as we get closer and closer to pitchers and catchers reporting. We get closer and closer to some set of guys landing jobs. We're still waiting. I'm like I've had trade talks about Bo Bichette, and I made a trade yesterday where I acquired Bryson Stott, and the trade talks about Bichette have all stalled because people are like, I don't know where he's playing. I don't know what position he's playing. Right. Like, and this talks on Stott started with the other manager in this league wanting a pitcher from me. A pitcher he wanted was Shane Bieber. I wasn't really sure what I wanted. I was open to trading Bieber. I'm sort of comfortable selling a little high because I think his value is still pretty high and there's some injury risk and stuff like that in there. And so I was like, yeah, sure. And we talked about Stott, and I need a middle infielder and I could use some speed. And so I was like, yeah, that makes sense. Except like the Phillies are supposed to meet with Bichette this week. I'm like, I don't know what that means. Like
Monday.
So like if he signs there, he's obviously, I mean, I shouldn't say this. I assume he's signing to play second base. It is possible that he's signing to play shortstop and they move Trey to center field. Maybe. But like if he plays second, I don't think Stott's really got the arm for third, but maybe he does. So maybe they move him to third and then Boehm is the odd. I just don't know. I don't know what to expect. So I was hesitant. I was just like, I don't know if I want to trade for Bryson Stott right now. And we ended up, I basically worked out like I'm getting Parker Messick along with Stott, and I'm giving up, I don't even remember, some prospect I don't really care about. Just to sort of nudge things a little bit more. And I was like, okay, fine. I'm fairly confident Stott will end up with a job somewhere. But like, I don't know. There's at least a chance that like the Phillies sign Bichette, displace Stott, and turn Stott into a utility guy. Right? I mean, it seems like a crazy thing to do, but
it's interesting because they're a team that has struggled with the glove so much. And although it's not the most important defensive position, Stott is a really good second baseman. So you have some stability defensively and you're going to muck that up. I don't know. I mean, I guess if you can get Bo Bichette, then you do that and you figure it out. And Bichette in Philly would certainly interest me. But yeah, I don't know. It might just be a lot of smoke. We've gotten a lot of smoke without any fires somehow this offseason. So we'll see.
Yeah. And I'm pulling up Savant now, and his Stott's arm strength is 27th percentile. Now, I don't know how much that is impacted by the fact that he plays second base and therefore doesn't make a lot of long, hard throws. Bichette's arm strength is no better. So like neither of those guys can really play third, I don't think. So like, I don't know. Maybe they can. Maybe the Phillies disagree with me and maybe they'll just put Stott at third or Bichette at third and trade Boehm. Or turn Boehm into a bench guy.
Constant possibility with Alec Boehm.
Yeah. So anyways, the point is that it's been weird waiting for this stuff to happen, but we have a bunch of listener questions that we got before our last episode. And we got through like some of them. I was going to say half of them, but that's not remotely true. So we're going to get through as many more of those as we can today. And we're going to start off with one from Henry on Auto News Slack. He says, here's one I've been debating. Is it worth maintaining fantasy control over a $3 to $5 top prospect? $3 to $5, sorry. Is it worth maintaining fantasy control over a $3 to $5 top prospect who struggled in 2025. And a short list he gave: Marcelo Meyer, who had 2.73 points per game in the majors and was then injured. Dalton Rushing at 1.99 points per game. Jordan Lawler at 1.65 points per game. He says probably no on Meyer, yes on Lawler, question mark on Rushing. And are there others to consider, such as Christian Campbell, Alex Freeland, Harry Ford? Pete, what's your reaction to this one?
So I was, as you were speaking, I was curious because I'm like, well, you know, top prospect means many different things. Some top prospects are 3 or 4 years away from the major leagues. Mm-hmm. Some top prospects have jobs. As it stands right now, quite a few of those guys have jobs, and I'm easily dropping $3 to $5 on them. Like I try not to be a homer. I think if you've been listening long enough, I try to avoid Red Sox players, but like I'm considering keeping a $7 Marcelo Meyer, because as of right now, he has a job, and I really don't think that's going to change. And in the case of Jordan Lawler, I think he's definitely going to play. That's why they have all but shut the door on Alex Bregman now by claiming that they're going to hold on to Ketel Marte. This is the Diamondbacks, of course. And they traded away Eugenio Suarez. Like all these guys, you know, Harry Ford, he's got a job now. The one I guess I'd be hesitant on is Campbell, because I'm willing to bet of these six, he didn't list the price. Campbell's probably his most expensive, and Campbell does not have a job right now. As a matter of fact, the Red Sox are, Campbell's not a good fielder anywhere, and the Red Sox still have too many outfielders. They have not found that dream deal. Like some people are tossing around the idea of Jaron Duran for Cole Reagans. I'm sorry, that Kansas City's not going to do that trade, no matter how many wins per season Duran has averaged over the last two seasons, which I think is something ridiculous. Like he's like a 5 or 6 win player. That's not happening. So in Campbell's case, he might be the one cut if he's like a $7 Campbell. The rest of them, I'd have to think about keeping all of them at that, in that price range.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so to be clear, like he is looking specifically at $3 to $5 guys who played in the majors last year and struggled, right? So we're not talking about the Connor Griffins or Jesus Mares or whatever of the world. Like these are guys who have debuted, they played, and they didn't perform, right? Because the other guy we're not talking about here is like a Nick Kurtz, right? Great. He's great. Awesome. My take on this at $3 to $5 is I'm not sure how much last year's performance matters to me at all.
Amen.
Right. It just was such a small sample with all of those guys. And it's a new data point. It is a data point worth considering. So maybe I shouldn't say it doesn't matter at all, but like I've got years of data on Marcelo Meyer that tells me what I think he's going to be, and I should be analyzing that. The fact that he struggled to adjust to major league pitching in his first look doesn't really change that much for me. Now, when I look at this particular list of guys, I think like Meyer and Lawler are easy keeps for me. Rushing, I don't know how much he's going to play.
Yeah.
And I'm just not sure. Like, I don't think he's as good a prospect as either of those two, and he has less playing time guarantee. And his lower playing time guarantee isn't like, oh, maybe it'll come in June or July. Like he may just, you know, get 100 plate appearances this year. Like that might just be what he is. And that might be the true, like, unless he gets traded or Will Smith gets traded, we're going to go into next season having the same conversation about Dalton Rushing. It's like, no, $3 to $5, I'm out on him. Some of those others, Campbell, I think that the struggle I have with Campbell is that not only was he not good last year, but the Red Sox seem to have, I want to be careful how I say this. I was going to say they seem to have given up on him, but I don't think that's true. But they have certainly made it clear that he is not a centerpiece of their plans. Let's put it that way. They're moving around to different spots. They don't have a position for him. They aren't worried about a position for him. If they thought he were that good a hitter, they don't trade for Wilson Contreras, right? Like, you don't make that deal if you think Campbell is a bat we have to make room for and we'll figure out where to play him, because you've just taken first base and DH completely off the table for Campbell for the foreseeable future. Not that that's where they want him to end up. They clearly, like, he's working in the outfield. They want him in the outfield. They don't have room in the outfield for him. And to your point, they could make a trade and still not have room in the outfield for him. Like, they've given me no indication that they believe that he's an important part of their present. They haven't given me any indication they don't think he's important for the future or that he doesn't have long-term value. But right now, I don't know. So I think Campbell, I'm having a little bit harder time on. I probably would be open to buying him at like the $3 to $5 range in an auction, but I'm less inclined to keep him now. By the auction, we'll know a little bit more. We'll have seen him in some certain training. And I think I'd rather do that. The other names in here, Alex Freeland, I'm just out on. He's looked good, but like, he's not going to play, right? There is no obvious path to him playing. Same thing with rushing. Ford, I'm a little bit more torn on. I don't know that he's quite as good a prospect, and his playing time's a little bit unclear, but I'd put him above rushing and Freeland, but probably below Campbell, and that, like, yeah, I could see it, but. And then I was trying to think of others who fall into this category, and I don't know. I mean, Carson Williams, Dylan Cruz, Adel Amador, Caglianone probably falls into this category of a guy who was up and didn't really perform. Basayo. I don't know. I'm just like naming names. I think like Jacob Mizorowski started off really well and then fell off the table and was bad. But in all of these cases, there's just, other than maybe Cruz, because he's had a little bit more time, these are all guys who I'm just like, who they were before they debuted is still who they are now. And I haven't really moved the needle much on them. Maybe Amador is another example of a guy who like Cruz, like he's not only struggled in the majors, but it's been a little bit longer and he seems to be struggling now in the minors as well. And so like, maybe I'm just sort of out on him, but most of these guys, I think wherever I was a year ago, I'm not that different right now. My bigger question to your point is, are they playing? Do they have a clear path to playing time? So like, even though Cruz might have a longer track record of struggling a bit, he's going to play this year. And so I'm at $3 to $5, I'm in on him. He probably costs you more than that, to be honest. And I don't think I want to pay a whole lot more than that, but that's okay. Caglianone, I'm still in on him. Basayo, I'm still in. Christian Moore, I don't know. He looked pretty bad, and I'm not really sure what's going on. Like, I don't really trust the Angels, and I'm a little less confident there. I don't know. I think that the net of this is I'm not looking super closely at something like Marcelo Mayer had 2.73 points per game last year. That is not the data point that I really care about.
I guess the defense for somebody who wanted to keep Campbell in that range, and I wouldn't. I would cut him in that range, but the Red Sox did give him an 8-year, $60 million extension. So there is investment there. And when he got sent down, it continued to be ugly, and then he got hot and started to hit again. I think he finished at AAA with like a 118 WRC plus, which is well below where he had been when he was on fire. But if they got Ketel Marte, then I would say, yeah, I mean, Christian Campbell may have actually ended up being in that trade. But now I feel like they need to get Bregman and have an answer at third base, and that still leaves second base is still kind of a question mark. Like, it could be Marcelo Meyer, and I expect him to perform better than he did, but if he is as bad or he gets hurt, which has been a constant problem for him, Christian Campbell's going to be right there waiting for his shot. Yeah. So that's the case for him, but I think I would still cut him in that range.
All right, let's jump to our next question. This comes from Paul T, who is in, Pete, I think he's in your home league, right?
Yep.
It's a question about your home league. So would you rather keep on a last round contract? So these are all guys who have last round contracts. Would you rather keep Connor Griffin, Bryce Aldridge, Sal Stewart, Kyle Stowers, or Cam Schlittler? I'm going to start here by saying I don't think Eldridge belongs in this conversation.
Definitely not.
And the reason for that is, if you're thinking maybe Eldridge, you would just keep Griffin. Right? Griffin's right. The better prospect. He actually might have a clearer path to playing time. So like, if you're focused on winning right now, I'd rather have Griffin than Eldridge. And if you're focused on the next 3 to 5 years, I'd rather have Griffin than Eldridge. So, like, to me, that's easy. Eldridge doesn't belong in this conversation. I think the harder call is if you're rebuilding and you want the upside, it's probably Griffin. If you're playing for right now, you probably want Stowers or Schlittler with the more guaranteed production. But it's, I mean, like, if I look at ADP right now over at NFBC, which is, you know, imperfect for this because it's not a keeper league, Stowers is going first to these guys at 115, Schlittler second at 130. Griffin and Stewart are like back to back at 202 for Stewart, 205 for Griffin, Eldridge 436. So I guess that backs up the Eldridge shouldn't be part of this conversation.
I think for me, I know you're a Sal Stewart guy. I think I'm also just ruling out Sal Stewart. Like I think I can both like Sal Stewart and also just can't rationalize keeping him over all three of those guys. Like, if you want to make a case, like, you should keep Sal Stewart over Cam Schlittler, like, okay, I could listen to that, but all three of them having a case for that, I don't know. Yeah. It's only a three keeper league, so rebuilding really shouldn't be a thing, but there is a huge advantage to getting a stud on a last round contract, obviously, in any league. But in this one, the inflation is only 2 rounds per season. So, you know, if Griffin does turn into a stud, then, you know, he's a 22nd rounder this year, next year, a 20th, then an 18th, then a 6th. I mean, you're keeping him throughout his entire prime at a primo price. Stowers a little bit older than I think people seem to think. He's a late breakout guy, kind of like a Jaren Duran level breakout guy, where I want to say Stowers is 27, he's 28.
He just turned 28.
Hey, happy birthday, Kyle Stowers. And like, that's not a big deal, but like, it's not like it is a big deal when you compare his age to Connor Griffin's. And Schlittler, I don't want to be the guy who passes up keeping a young stud like Griffin because I got swept up in postseason dominance. I think Schlittler could be awesome. And in this league, pitching does get pushed way up, but oh man, I would kick myself for years if Connor Griffin turns into some stud and I got swept up in a couple of postseason starts from Schlittler. Not that he was only good in the postseason, and he has a killer arsenal. He throws the ball so hard. He does seem like he has what it takes to succeed in New York. I hate those conversations, but for what it's worth, I think he has that. I don't know. I'd still rather take my shot at the stud hitter. I think my answer here is Connor Griffin.
Yeah, I get that. I think for me, it's either Griffin or Stowers. And it really does come down to, would you rather take the riskier, higher payoff move that's going to be potentially much worse this year? Right? Like, Griffin may not be up till August. Like, there's talk about him being up sooner, but like, we don't really know.
And it's the Pirates.
Yeah. Although the Pirates seem to be behaving differently, so, you know, who knows? It's also like, that's not a good park to hit in, so like, who knows how that's going to affect him when he comes up? Like, I think it's just one of those two for me. You could make a case that Schlittler splits the difference, that he is not as likely as Griffin to be like a first or second round pick next year. But he's more likely to make that leap than Stowers is. Sure. He's also not as likely as I think Stowers. Like, if you're talking about pure value for this year, I'd rather have Stowers this year than Schlittler. But it's close. So I could see the case for Schlittler. I could see the case for Stowers. I get what you're saying on Griffin. I am more likely to keep the guy who I can count on producing. I think I would have spent the offseason, though, trying to trade somebody.
Yeah, he's got time. Our keeper lock date is usually not until, like, March. I think important and, like, funny context, and if he listens to this, he's going to be upset that I said this, but that offseason, I can't remember what year it was 3 or 4 years ago, where, like, the draft stock of Jordan Walker and Anthony Volpe was just like taking off because it was looking like both were going to, and both did, like, start the season with their teams. he had like two early picks in the first round or something, and he drafted both of them, and they were like the two most colossal, horrendous busts, as we all know, or Jordan Walker and Anthony Volpe. So that might make him less inclined now to take such a gamble on Connor Griffin and maybe just bank Kyle Stowers.
I can understand, you know, get burned like that. Maybe yeah, just, that's just make the safe move. Oof,
both of them.
That is rough. So let's do one more question before we take a break. I think this will be relatively quick. This came from Ben in the Discord. I think he's in the Pitcherless Discord. I'm not sure, actually. But 14-team Dynasty League added a second utility spot this offseason since there are so many DH-only hitters now. How would this change affect your strategy? So I am in a dynasty league that made the same change this offseason. It's a 12-team, not a 14-team. Otherwise, I might think that I was in the same league, but I'm not. We made that decision via vote after I was pushing for a fifth outfielder, and others said, why don't we do a second utility player instead? I personally much prefer a fifth outfielder. I don't think there's any need to go to a second utility. For what it's worth in this league, which is on Fantrax, I have both Otani and Yelich, who are both DH only, and I was going to have to deal with that this offseason. And they solved that problem for me, which is great. So it worked out well for me. But the idea of making this change, because there are so many DH only hitters, who are we talking about? I'm going to list every single DH hitter in the top 200 at NFBC. Otani, Schwarber, Yordan Alvarez, Yelich, and Ivan Herrera, five. They're five in the top 200. If you go to the top 300, you add, I think, nope, that's not even true. You add Ballesteros, I think, is the only one in the top 300. Beyond that, Jock, Yoshida, Ozuna is going like way outside the top 300 now. Eldridge, we just said, is going outside the top 400. Adrian Del Castillo, George Valera, half these guys are going to pick up positions at some point during the season anyways. And half of them aren't draft worthy.
Yeah.
Right. So I'll start with this. Like, I reject the premise. There are not so many guys who are DH only. That's just a factually untrue thing. Especially in a 14-team league. There is literally no reason any team in a 14-team league should need two utility spots. The only thing the second utility spot does in a 14-team league is give a huge benefit to anyone who has Otani, Schwarber, Yordan, or Yelich, for that matter. If you've spent, but it's really those three, but if you have a top 30 to 50 type pick who's util only, or you're even Yelich, who's more like a top, 150 type pick, but especially those other three. You have one of those guys, and now all of a sudden, you just get a bonus utility spot. That is a huge win. And I don't think we need to do anything to boost the value of those guys. So I reject the premise. The answer of how this changes my strategy, though, is I push up those guys. Those guys are just all more valuable now. And it's literally only those five players. The only five players that move up for me are Otani, Schwarber, Yordan, Yelich, and maybe Ivan Herrera. Those are the five guys who move up my draft board. And Otani was probably already first anyways. So he's moved up from 1-1. Schwarber moves up, Yordan moves up, Yelich moves up, and maybe I bump Herrera a little bit. But that's it. That's the only way it affects my strategy at all.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, Herrera, I like, and so I would bump him up, I guess. But like, if I was drafting him already, it's not like, oh man, he's util only, but I'm going to take him. It's eventually, I'm hoping he's getting that catcher eligibility, yeah, so I can put him a catcher. So it has less to do with the utility and more to, like you said, a lot of these guys, Ballesteros, maybe a lot of these guys are going to gain positional eligibility outside of utility. So I do think
for like Herrera or Ballesteros, like, the fact that, like, yes, you are, I am drafting Herrera if I draft him because I think he'll get catcher. He adds floor if you have a second utility spot because he's just easier to use and less costly to you.
right? If he never gets that catcher eligibility, you can survive that in a way that you can't if you only have one utility spot. So that's why it pushes him up a little bit. It's maybe it's less saying that it pushes him up. It's more saying that without, if you only have one utility spot, the fact that he isn't guaranteed catcher should push him down and you take that penalty away. But in general, I would say if you're considering adding a lineup spot, like I wouldn't add a second utility spot unless you're already at like one or maybe even two catchers for sure. Middle infield. And like, if you have a two catcher league with middle infield, corner infield, and five outfielders, and you think you need a second util because that's just what your league wants, I get it. But until I have all of those things in place, I would much rather add regular positions before I add a second utility.
Agreed.
All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we got some more questions to go through. All right, welcome back to the Keeper Cup podcast. Chad Young and Pete Ball with you, going through some listener questions. This one comes from Chalwa in the Discord, one of the guys in one of our listener leagues. Says
he's my home league too.
Oh, nice. And in an auto new league, because his question is about an auto new league. He says, looking to rebuild in an auto new league. From your experience, what is the best time to sell expensive players for cheaper assets? Before the season, when everybody thinks there's a chance, or mid-season, when some managers are in the hunt for a title? And what exactly are you looking for in return? High upside, proximity, value, guys rebounding from a bad year, all of the above. What are your thoughts on this, Pete? What do you think is the best time to sell?
I've found during the season, especially in like our League 13, I don't know if all the leagues have the same playoff format. I imagine they do, but I mean, what, half the league makes the playoffs, right? Which means even more than that is vying for an opportunity to make the playoffs. So like you can really do pretty well trading during the season to rebuild your team. I'm combing through that entire question. I guess that's what exactly you're looking for in return. I'm looking for value. I don't really care if it's an older player, a younger player. I want to set myself up with as many pieces that will allow me to do as much as I want in the auction while also fielding a valuable team. So I'm not going to like sell out and be like, all right, I have this expensive player that I'm not going to keep. I'm going to sell him and I'm only looking for prospects and end up with like a whoever this year's like $9 equivalent of a Connor Griffin would be, because that's too expensive for me. I don't know if I'm going to end up keeping a $9 Connor Griffin. I'd frankly might just rather have a $1. I know you don't like this player, Chris Bubich, because there's just so much more value there that I could cash in. So I'm not saying, just for the record, for Keeper Cut listeners, I'm not saying I prefer Chris Bubich to Connor Griffin. I feel like that is a statement that could really come back to bite me. I just prefer value on less exciting players than just going for young guys because I'm, quote, rebuilding. I don't follow that methodology at all.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, the short answer to this question, since it's being asked in, well, it was asked in January, December, asked in December, we're answering it in January. The short answer is not right now. This is not the time to do that, because right now you're like $60 Juan Soto might be valuable and might be a keeper in your league and you might get a good return for him, but he uses up $60 of cap space for a team. As soon as the auction is over, you can trade the guy for a loan with a loan and get a much better return. So the broad answer here is, from the moment the auction ends until the trade deadline in August, that's the window when you should be looking to make trade these guys. My thing is, I very rarely want to come out of an auction looking to rebuild.
Agreed.
I can't really think of many times that that's happened. And so the end result of that is the only window in which I'm trading these guys is like at the earliest, early to mid-May. If I have a team that just really everything has gone sideways, the guys I was counting on aren't performing. I have a couple of big injuries that are like, you know, I have two aces on a team. They both just went down with Tommy John. I have a stud bat who tore his ACL, and I have three guys I was counting on who are just straight up not performing.
okay, fine. I'll trade in early May. Otherwise, it's probably like June, July before I'm like, yeah, this team just, it's not going to happen this year.
Hmm.
The earlier you can make that decision, the better. But the earlier you make that decision, the less chance you give yourself to win. So I think, yeah, that's my answer to when. As for what, I agree with what you said. It's just value. If I'm looking at prospects, I do want high upside, but that's because I think high upside prospects have more value. I do want guys with proximity because I think that is part of having good value. I will say, generally speaking, if I'm trading in like June and I'm trading a stud, the guys I get back better be playing in the majors soon. Like, I don't want some like 18-year-old kid in A ball or some like newly drafted guy who is drafted out of high school and is 3-4 years away. Those guys might be good to like close out a deal, right? Like if it's June and I'm selling and I'm, you know, the headliner in the deal is a guy like, let's say, Walker Jenkins. Say he has a great first half. It looks like he might have a shot to debut in the second half. If not, it'll be early the next season. Like, fine. If there's some newly drafted guy or some guy in A-ball who is the secondary piece in that, okay, I get that. There's value there. But I want my primary return to be guys who I think will produce for me next year at a good price so that I can buy the rest of the team around them. So that's what I'm looking for. All right, let's jump to the next one. This comes from Roadkill on the Auto News Slack. Wants to know, are there any hitters, catchers, or pitchers that you think will benefit the most from the new ABS rules? Pete, I put together a spreadsheet on this that I can talk about what I found. Do you have any thoughts first, though?
No, I just want to hear what's on the spreadsheet.
Okay. I'm going to start with this. From a fantasy perspective, this isn't going to impact catchers at all, right? I mean, I don't care about the impact on catchers. Because the only way this impacts a catcher is if a catcher is... So catchers who are good or bad at framing will be impacted. A poor framing catcher who has a good sense of the strike zone will benefit from this, right? Because they will have some of the strikes they don't get. You know, a pitch that's called a ball that should have been a strike, they can get back. Great. And they aren't, you know, stealing very many strikes, so they don't stand to lose very much. And the counterpoint to that on catchers is like Patrick Bailey, who's a great framer. Like, this probably is bad for him because on the one hand, he probably has a good idea of the strike zone. He'll probably do a good job when he challenges. But like, let's call it what it is, right? Framing is stealing strikes. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I think framing is part of the game and it's totally fine. I'm a fan of framing existing in baseball, but it is trying to make a pitch look good. And sometimes that's making sure a strike is called a strike. And sometimes it's trying to make a borderline pitch called a strike. Those borderline pitches are going to turn into balls more often than they used to. So it's going to hurt a guy like Bailey. There is at the margins a possibility like a guy, like it could hurt Bailey enough that he loses his job. Not this year, but over the next couple of years. But from a fantasy perspective, I don't care. It is possible also that someone who's a more of a borderline framing catcher who's great offensively could keep catcher eligibility because of this. I just don't think that's likely to be where this goes. So I'm not really worried about the effect on catchers. So here's what I did. I went to Baseball Savant and I pulled percent of pitches for both hitters and I did this for hitters and pitchers. Let's talk hitters first. So for hitters, the percent of pitches that they saw last year that were in the shadow zone, right? So you got the zone. So you basically have like pitches that are strikes and you have pitches that are balls. And you've got the shadow zone that's sort of on the edges of the strike zone that are a little bit borderline. And whether they're called balls or strikes tends to vary. And just as an example, if I look at what percentage of these pitches were called balls to players, the player who had the fewest of these called balls got 45% of them. The one who had the most had 73%. So these pitches, anywhere from, you know, 25 to 55% of them are strikes, anywhere from 45 to 75 are balls. They're borderline. So what I looked at was tried to look at, for hitters and pitchers, two things. One, who just sees a lot of these?
Like, which hitters are just getting a ton of pitches that are borderline? Because those are the ones that might get overturned. And interestingly, it was not a very interesting list. So here are the list of names. I know. Here are the list of names. The top shadow rate, and shadow rate in this case is percent of pitches they saw that were in the shadow zone. Joshua Palacios, Jack Suwinski, Leody Tavares, Heriberto Hernandez, Cameron Meisner, Willy Castro, Jamai Jones, Will Benson, Zach McKinstry, Ha-Seong Kim, Edmundo Sosa. You want to stop me when I get to someone you care about? Like, it's not.
Doesn't sound like that'll ever happen.
No. So that's one thing. The guys who get the most pitches in this zone are not that interesting. The guys who get the fewest pitches in the zone: Zach Neto, Warning Bermabel, Dylan Beavers, Marcelo Mayer got some of the fewest pitches in the zone. Bryce Harper, Jonkenzie Noel, Davis Schneider, Yiner Diaz, Alexander Canario, JJ Bleday. They're both extremes of this are sort of somewhat uninteresting. You do, at least on this end, have like Beavers and Mayer who are interesting prospects. You have Harper and you have Neto who are actually good, productive players. So like, there's at least some things here, but I'm not sure I really learned much by looking at this. I don't think I did. So instead, what I did is I turned my attention to guys who got the highest percentage of these pitches called either in their favor or against them. So Corey Seager had 73% of balls in this area called balls. So 73% of these borderline pitches, way more than anyone else. Second place in this is 69%. He's the only player over 70%.
That's so weird.
It is. Like, and I'm not sure why that is.
Something that's not going to be sticky, you know?
I agree. But if you're looking at a player, if you're looking at his season last season, ABS would have hurt him, right? Because these are the pitches that are most likely to get challenged and overturned. And he had a lot of them, and they went in his favor. Others that are in that zone where ABS last year, and I want to be clear, this is ABS last year would have probably hurt them. The top guys, Seager, Luke Raley, Will Benson, who showed up on the list of the most pitches in the shadow zone too. So that's a big effect on him. Matt Wallner, Ezekiel Tovar, Ronald Acuna Jr., Dalton Varsho, Rafi Devers, Lawrence Butler, Jackson Merrill. I could keep going on. I think the thing that I notice here is there are a decent chunk of good hitters who just had a lot of pitches go in their way in that part of the zone. If I look at the bottom of this list, the guys who had the fewest balls called for them in that part of the zone, it's Wilmer Flores, Tyler Fitzgerald, Ezekiel Duran, Jose Altuve, Johan Rojas, Otto Lopez, Abraham Toro, Chase Meadroth, Austin Slater. Again, I could keep going. But I do think that one of the things we're going to see here is, and this shouldn't be a huge surprise, good hitters get the benefit of the doubt, right? Like, I think the reason Seager's at the top of that list, at least in part, is I think there is an impact there of Seager getting the benefit of the doubt on those calls. That therefore means that this would hurt. On average, the better a hitter is, the more often they get the benefit of the doubt, the more this could hurt them.
So I was, while you were saying that, I was thinking about the inverse of, I think back to Julio Rodriguez's rookie season, where like he struck out in the first like 3 months of his career or something, he struck out like 18 times on balls. And so I was thinking of like younger players, not just hitters who don't like for whatever reason get the calls, but also pitchers who like, oh, he hasn't earned that call yet. Like, I hate that crap. Like, the thing is either a ball or a strike. It really doesn't matter how long you've been in the league or who you are. The pitch should be a ball or a strike based on where it is in the zone, if it is in the zone. And I guess that would be my, because a lot of this stuff I'd be hesitant to say it's sticky, but I think general assumptions like, okay, maybe like younger players have an easier time getting acclimated because they're not, you know, striking out four times in a game and three of the strikeouts were on balls, Or, you know, as you were saying, the impact could be like the generalization could be, well, better hitters do tend to get the benefit of the doubt, whereas younger ones don't. So maybe, you know, that has some impact. I just think like from player to player, that is going to be a difficult one to square up, you know, like if that number. Go ahead.
Yeah. And that's where I was going when I said this is the impact from if we had this last year.
Right.
Part of this is I don't know that this is very sticky. I suspect it is not. And the other part is, I don't think for most hitters, this is going to be a huge impact. It's not going to be like a call every game.
Right.
Right. Teams get, I can't remember what the number is. They get a handful of challenges, and if they're right, they get to keep using them. But if they're wrong, they run out. And I think there's a couple of things that are going to happen here that are going to work to the benefit of these better players that are going to counteract that. One is, I think teams are going to have rules about who can and can't challenge calls.
Probably.
Like, if I'm the Yankees, one of the first things I'm doing is saying, if your name isn't Aaron Judge, keep your hand off your helmet, right? Because a bad called strike against Aaron Judge that turns into a ball could change an entire game. Jose Caballero, you're a wonderful baseball player. Do not care if you strike out on a bad call. It is okay. You are probably going to get out anyways.
Guys in contract years are going to be... Like, good luck getting Jazz Chisholm to agree to that one.
Well, the good thing is you may be able to, like, Jazz may be good enough that you're like, okay, yeah, fine. Jazz, yeah. You're on the list. But, like, I do think teams are literally going to have lists of, like, do not waste a challenge that could be used by a guy who has game-changing offensive abilities. And so I think we're going to see some, like, I think that will therefore, you know, Corey Seager gets the benefit of the doubt more often than other guys. So this might hurt him. He's also going to be one of the guys the Rangers are like, yeah, if you think it's wrong, call, like, challenge it. And to the same effect, I think, like, Juan Soto, who notoriously has a great sense of the strike zone, Stephen Kwan, who has a great sense of the strike zone, even a guy like Kyle Schwarber doesn't chase a lot. He strikes out a lot, but he strikes out a lot because he has a lot of swing and miss. Those guys are also going to get more freedom from their teams to use these challenges because they won't get them wrong. And when they don't get them wrong, the team will get to keep them and someone else gets to use it later anyways. So right. I think that'll balance things out. I don't think it's going to help a lot of hitters in enough to matter. I don't think there's any hitter that I'm looking at that I'm like, their fantasy value is going to go up because of this. I just think it's going to be a small effect, and I think that they're offsetting effects on good players where the star calls won't happen or won't stick, but those guys will have more access to fixing bad calls, and so I think that'll sort of balance out. On the pitcher side, now this is another interesting one. If I go look at guys who live in the shadow zone, so just for what it's worth, the highest shadow rate for a pitcher is over 50%, just over 50%. The lowest is 35%. A pretty wide range. I also think this is something that, while may not be sticky from the perspective that it's something you can work on, I suspect throwing pitches to the shadow zone is a skill. And the guys at the top of this list who do it the most often, Aaron Nola, Tyler Molly, Devin Williams, Brandon Young, Eduardo Rodriguez, Trevor Rogers, Paul Blackburn, Chris Paddock, yeah, I keep going from there. But it's a number of pitchers who have pretty good command, who know where they're going with the ball. Even if they walk guys, those are guys who are, to some extent, know what they're doing. The bottom of the list, Brendan Little, Reed Garrett, Roky Sasaki, Brant Herder, Stephen Cruz, Brock Stewart, Cade Gibson, Fernando Cruz, Shohei Ohtani, and Jack Perkins. Now, Ohtani's a little bit of an outlier coming back from injury, and I'm not really sure, like, I want to read a lot into this. But that's a lot of guys who are not particularly great and who maybe don't have a great sense of where the ball is going. Like, Fernando Cruz is a great example of a pitcher who's got good stuff, and, like, he throws the ball where he throws it. And so it's not a huge surprise that a guy like that misses by a lot, and then when he throws strikes, they're strikes. And so they're not... So I would start with that. Guys who don't have great command, who don't necessarily know where the ball is going, they often miss badly, either in or out of the zone, or they throw strikes. And they're not trying to paint corners, and so they're not looking at these borderline calls, and so those guys won't be affected. I think a guy like Nola, and I'd be curious to look, and I should have done this, to look to see if Nola, if this is like consistent over his career. But I think a guy like Nola, like Tyler Molly, like these guys could benefit from that. I think teams will give starting pitchers in particular the freedom to challenge these. They'll give their catchers freedom to challenge these. And pitchers who have good control, who live near the strike zone, I think are going to benefit from this. Molly had the second most pitches in the shadow zone of any pitcher last year and was above average in the percentage of those that were called against him. If he continues to live in that zone and adds Patrick Bailey as his catcher, right? Because he's with San Francisco now, right?
Yep.
And gets ABS working to his benefit with him and Bailey being able to work in concert on using ABS, I think Molly stands to benefit a lot. And that's what I'd be looking at is like pitchers. First of all, I'd look mostly at starting pitchers and closers. I think middle relievers, a little bit like I was saying with like the sort of, you know, Jose Caballeros of the world. I think teams are not going to tell their starters they can't use it. And they're going to want those challenges available for a big moment in a high leverage situation in the ninth inning. And so I think they are often going to tell, you know, your guy in the seventh inning, like, just suck it up and move on. Especially if they've used up a challenge or two by then and it's riskier. So I think that what you're going to see is closers and starters will benefit more from it because they will be able to use it more. And I think pitchers who live in that shadow zone, again, like Nola, like Molly, like Devin Williams, will benefit the most from it. And Molly was the name who stood out to me as having a lot of pitches in that zone and a lot of them called against him. And so, yeah, Tobias Myers is pretty high on both of those lists. Zach Littell, pretty high on both of those lists. Shota Imanaga, pretty high on both of those lists. Ranger Suarez, pretty high on the list of guys who live in the shadow zone. Not a huge surprise that that's true, but he did a pretty good job of getting those pitches called for him. And I think that'll just continue. So that's my take on ABS.
That's a lot of good stuff. I think with pitchers, and this doesn't really make sense because these calls affect both hitters and pitchers every time they're going to be called. But like, I just feel like with pitchers, the data might be a little bit more sticky because pitchers are in control. Well, the good ones are in control of where the ball is going. So those guys who do tend to live in the shadows, like you said, that could have an impact one way or another. I think guys like you mentioned Littell, like Littell is just known for pounding the zone. And I think in a way that's like the less respected, but same kind of mindset pitcher version of like Juan Soto, where how much of it is like umpires just kind of trust these guys where like if it's close, they just give it to that player because that's what they're known for doing. And I could see it having a marginal impact on those guys. But I just at the end of the day, I think the impact on fantasy is going to be really negligible if just not existent.
Yeah, I generally agree with that. Pete, I have a question for you. So this is a question that just came in, which is at some point during my extended speech on ABS impact, you made a bunch of cuts in our listener league.
I did.
Were you listening to me? You just were like, "Ah, Chad's droning on. I'm going to go make my cuts right now." Is that what just happened? That's my question.
I'm always on my toes, man. I'm always ready for it. But now I have like a bunch of tabs open, and I'm not like a big tab person. And I've had my new potential cuts, and it was the Francisco Alvarez for $6. That I was just like, man, I don't know if I want to do this or not. But it's 4x4. It's only one catcher. Well, one season's worth of catcher, 162. So I went with the cut. But no, I'm always listening, Chad.
Man, I might have traded for that Alvarez. I'd have to
now you don't have to see.
No, I don't have to. That's true. And actually, I'm gonna skip ahead to one of our later questions because it's related to one of your cuts. But Let's take a quick break first, then we'll come back to that. All right, welcome back to the Keeper Cup podcast. One of the last questions on our list, but we're going to pull it up. It's from another one from Chal Awa on the Discord. What is your take on the pitching? Christian, what is the take, your take on pitching in Cleveland and Boston? I assume he's asking me about Cleveland and you about Boston, but you cut a $14 Tanner Bibee among those guys you just cut. So I'm going to start with, what are your thoughts on the pitching in Cleveland? Because it seems like you're not that high on Bibee, and he's nominally our number two, maybe our number one. I don't know.
Yeah, we hashed this one out when we went over our Otnu Keeper Cut League. Oh my God, I'm getting my words all jumbled here. Our Keeper Cut League Otnu rosters. And it was because of all the other pitchers that I have that I ultimately said goodbye to Bibee. Even with cutting him, I'm still rostering, I don't know, like 7 or 8 starting pitchers, including some expensive ones, like a $31 Logan Webb. I guess that's only my really expensive one, but I've got a $15 King, $15 Yuri Perez, $7 Bubba Chandler. I still like Jonah Tong, despite the lack of success in his early going here for $6. I'm even keeping 3 relievers, which I would almost never thought I would ever do in 4x4. $5 Bayo, $3 Logan Henderson, and a $9 Garrett Cole. So it's not that I don't like Bibee. It's just I'm going to need that money to spend elsewhere. And honestly, I like Bibee, and I'm thrilled that he finished the season strong. But it was almost too little too late, where it was such a disaster of a season for a guy who I really, really liked. So, I mean, if it was even $4 or $5 cheaper, I'm probably keeping him. I just, at that price point, I just couldn't do it based on what he did last year.
Yeah, and I mean, it's hard to argue with that. He did, for what it's worth, in September, you know, significantly dropped his walk rate, raised his strikeout rate, had a 2.38 FIP for the month of September. He also had a 3.20 FIP in June and a 3.57 in May, and then fell apart again. So like, it was a very up and down year for him. And so I don't disagree with that. I was just giving you a hard time, but yeah, Bibee, I think he's a decent buy low. I just think that his ceiling, without all the strikeouts, is like, if he can keep the walks in line, he could be a really valuable pitcher, but not, you know, there's not ace potential in there from a fantasy perspective.
And he's had some decently big strikeout games, I think. Like he's had 8 or 9 strikeout games on multiple occasions. I mean, part of it is just how much he pounds the zone, right? Like those guys are going to have the occasional big strikeout game. Like even like Logan Webb, and he'll have a bunch of, he had over 200 strikeouts last year. So I wouldn't even write off Bibee being a strikeout contributor if he can figure out whatever the hell went wrong for him last year. I still like the player.
Yeah, he did have, I mean, he had 2 10 strikeout games and 3 8 strikeout games. 2 of those 5 occurred in September. One was against the White Sox, but the other was against Detroit. They were a real team. So yeah, he had 162 strikeouts in the season. I think he's an interesting buy low. I don't think he's an ace. I think Gavin Williams still has ace upside, but I think he might actually be a little bit of a sell high. The underlying, like his walk rate stayed up, you know, and his numbers overall were still good, right? 3.06 ERA, 4.39 FIP, 4.08 XFIP. And he did seem to improve a bit as the season went on in some ways. Like his strikeout rate went up as the season went on. But he was sort of up and down on his walk rate. And I think like he started the year, I mean, it's interesting. It depends where you cut things, because like his September was his, well, actually, no, that's not true. I'm looking at this wrong. His August and September were his 2 best months by of walk rate on the season, and his 2 best months of strikeout rate, 2nd and 3rd best month of strikeout rate. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he did show more improvement than I'm really like giving him credit for. And if you look at like his K minus BB, it was 9% in the first half, 18.4% in the second half. So there's growth there. He needs to show he can do it consistently, and I'm a little bit not sure he can. And so that's why I think he's a little bit of a sell high. And then if I go beyond that in Cleveland, I don't think there's any need to be buying in on Slade Ciccone. I like Ciccone. I think he could be good, but he's like a watch list guy for me.
He was fun last year.
He's fine. Yeah. But he's like, you know, you need innings at some point. Sure. If he starts to show something different in spring or in April, sure. I don't need him on my rosters, though. Logan Allen is even a step below that. The guys that I'm interested in the depth there are Joey Cantillo and Parker Messick, who I think both are quite good. I wrote about Cantillo over on Fangraphs last week. You should go check it out if you want to hear more about it, because we're getting long here and I don't want to go any deeper on him than I have to. But I'm a fan of Cantillo. I think he's gonna be good, and I like what Messick brings. And so like those are the two guys in the like that I'm most interested in sort of buying in the Cleveland rotation. But it's in part because like Messick, I think, doesn't start the year in the rotation, which will keep his price down. And I think there's enough questions about Cantillo that his price will stay down. So this is not me saying that I think Cantillo and Messick are better than Williams and Bybee. I think they're better values than Williams and Bybee, compared to what it would cost to acquire them or what you could get for trading them right now.
I think Williams is a fun bridge to the other part of the question about the Red Sox, because we all have like random reasons why we like players, and we have our own biases and stuff. And I think that's part of what makes fantasy baseball so fun. But for me, the type of pitcher that Gavin Williams is just somebody that I'm almost always going to believe in. It's not just the organization he's coming from and the prospect pedigree, and I think those two things help a lot. But when you have a pitch as good as his fastball, and like I know the results weren't there, and he had a weird year. Like the surface level numbers are like, oh my God, the breakouts here. This is who we all thought. You look at the numbers under the hood, and it's like, maybe not. The swing strike rate, super low. The ERA estimators were not very good. But he is such a good fastball. It is a dominant major league, like standout pitch that I think if you're going to become something in baseball, if you're going to become an ace, if you have actual ace upside, you need a pitch that is that good. I think of like when Luis Castillo was breaking out with the Reds, that changeup, he could just throw it like 60% of the time in some of his starts when he didn't have his stuff, and he could still end up with a pretty good start because that pitch was so freaking good. And so I bridge that to the Red Sox part, where there's a guy who's not going to be a part of the rotation at the beginning of the year, but has a fastball that could be just as good or even better than Gavin Williams's, and that's Peyton Tolle. So I think Conley Early got a lot of the early, no pun intended, hype now, or I guess late hype after they both got promoted, because Tolle didn't have immediate success. He had a pretty good initial outing, and then the wheels kind of came off, whereas Conley Early looked really good. And I'm excited that both of those players are on my team, but the best pitch between those two pitchers is Peyton Tolle's fastball. I just think it's such a strong foundation. He's got such a big frame like Gavin Williams. Like, I think there's some comparisons there between those two pitchers. And I am very excited about the both of them. I hear what you're saying when it comes to value for Messick and Cantillo over Gavin Williams and Tanner Bybee. And I definitely think so in Bybee's case. I just can't quit a player like Gavin Williams. So you have that one dominant pitch. Like that's such a crutch for me, or I don't know what the terminology would be, but that is such something that I'm a sucker for. And I really think Gavin Williams' fastball is just that good.
That's totally reasonable. I think to your point on Tolle and Early, they are the two most, well, there's Crochet and Gray at the top of the Boston rotation. And like those guys are
not a lot.
They are what they are. Yeah. Right. And that's fine. Then you've got this weird situation where Tolle and Early are, I think, pretty unquestionably the next two most talented pitchers in that organization. But they're younger. They're not necessarily next in line. It's like if you go to Roster Resource right now, you see Brian Bello, Johan Oviedo, and Patrick Sandoval as their 3, 4, 5. And they just traded for Oviedo, which makes me think, One of two things happening. Either they think he's like high-end reliever material, and we just don't know that that's their plan yet. Or they expect him to be in the rotation. They didn't trade for him. I guess he has an option. Maybe they did trade for him just so they could burn the option and have him. But I presume he's a lock for one of those spots. Patrick Sandoval does not have an option. And teams very rarely just dump a guy. Now, if he sucks in spring, they'll just dump him. But if he's looks decent in spring, is doing the things they need him to do, he probably gets a spot. What's the timeline on Cutter Crawford? Because he's the other name on here.
I believe all systems are a go. Should be healthy for spring training. So eight guys right there. Mm-hmm. It's a nice problem to have for once for the Red Sox. I will say that this level of depth is nice. Now, if five of the eight of them are horrible, that really doesn't help either. I think as a fantasy manager, this isn't going to be very helpful if you're in a shallow league, because it would make literally all of these guys cuts probably. But I think you kind of pencil in Bayo, Crochet and Gray to just be starters the whole year. They should be 30 plus starts if they're healthy. From there, you begin to tier them. I think we're looking at, if I was going to be conservative with it, Sandoval and Crawford, I would put like 8 to 12 starts each. And Tolle and Early, I would pencil them in for something like, 18 to 22 starts each. And I guess the wild card there is Oviedo, but you're right, they just traded for him. And like, I didn't know all this about him. Like, his extension is crazy. He throws the ball so hard.
He's a Breslow guy.
Yeah, exactly. He fits that mold that he's hunting for. So I think I'd put him somewhere in between those two. Like Tolle and Early, I think they're going to want to get a lot of looks at, and they've earned them. Well, they deserve them anyway. So I'd say 16 to 22 starts each. And then, Oviedo somewhere between those guys, and Crawford and Sandoval, who I'd say somewhere between like 9 and 12 starts. Crawford's come out of the bullpen before. That's not a foreign spot for him. They might need him there anyway. Sandoval, who knows? Like you said, Sandoval might come out in the spring and just suck. And like, that's it.
He wasn't
very good before his injury. No. So
I would bet that Sandoval gets DFA'd at some point or traded for not peanuts at some point. I just think that we are unlikely, unless spring is awful, we are unlikely to see that before opening day. It's more like May.
Yeah.
And that means that I think we are going into the season with Crochet, Gray, Bayo, Oviedo, and Sandoval, unless Sandoval really pitches his way off the roster in a hurry.
Yeah.
And I do think, to your, like, as where I started with this, to your point about shallow leagues and redraft leagues, if you're in a shallow redraft league, I don't think I would draft Early or Tolle. I just don't think I would.
I agree.
Because I just, right. Because if you're in a shallow league, you're not going to be able to put them on the IL. So you're going to have them using up a bench spot until they get called up. And you're going to have no real good sense of when that's going to be. Now, we may get more information in the next couple months that proves that, hey, they're going to be in the rotation. Sandoval's actually, gets shipped out ahead of time, whatever. Like, those things could happen. But barring that, I think you have to assume those guys are starting in the minors, and maybe it's April, maybe it's May, maybe it's June. Like, we just don't know when it's going to happen. And in a shallow redraft, I don't want to play with that. In a keeper league or in a deeper league, I think at some level, those are the only two guys from that depth group that I'm interested in. I don't think Bayo is that interesting from a fantasy perspective. Oviedo, maybe, if he, but it's more of like, I want to see what he does in spring. And like,
yeah, it's not right now.
Certainly not Sandoval and not Crawford. So in a keeper league, in a deeper format, I'm in on Tolle and Early. But yeah, I think it's the Red Sox. It's weird because the Red Sox rotation is such that even though I think Tolle and Early are more interesting, I was trying to figure out the right phrase. They're definitely more interesting to me than Messick and Cantillo. I think Messick and Cantillo are more likely to make more starts this year. Cantillo is out of options. He will be in the opening day rotation. Where he slots into that, I don't know. Allen, Ciccone, and Messick, I think all have at least one. Messick has three because when he got called up last year, he never got sent back down. So they never optioned him. So they have not burned an option on Messick yet. Allen and Ciccone each have one.
Are we really going to do this again with Logan Allen?
Well,
so I'd be so disappointed if he gets the job over Messick. That would suck.
I mean, here's the thing. Allen has had two basically full-ish seasons. 2023, he had a sub-4 ERA, 3.81 ERA, 4.19 FIP in 125 innings. Came back the next year and was bad, like bad in 2024. In 2025, he went 156 and two-thirds innings with a 4.25 ERA, 4.37 WHIP or FIP. That's not like world-changing stuff, but in 156 innings, that's 1.7 WAR. That's a league average starting pitcher. That's a totally acceptable starting pitcher. And so I think Messick and Cantillo are definitely higher upside and more interesting. But Allen is
that a 1.4 WHIP, man. That like even like you said, the ERA and the innings total might be league average, but a WHIP of 1.4.
I mean, I guess are we talking fantasy or are we talking reality here? Because in reality, I like Allen. I think he's a totally fine back of the rotation kind of guy. In fantasy, you don't need to draft him. We don't have to worry about him.
I think a major league team, major league teams don't give a crap about WHIP like a fantasy manager does. But I just think it's a sign that like Messick, give the job to Messick.
Yeah, I think the fact that Allen has an option gives him a shot. Gives Messick a shot, but I suspect they will choose to burn one of Messick's three options rather than burn Allen's last option to start the season. And I think that's, to be clear, as a Guardians fan, I'm not bothered by that. I don't think that's the wrong decision. Both of these guys are going to be needed next year. And giving Allen the first go at this, first of all, maybe he's great and they never need to option him. Awesome. Maybe he's not great and they need to get rid of him right away, or maybe he gets hurt. But there's a lot of paths to Allen not using that option and being someone they could option next year and be back in the same, the good side of the situation is they get to choose. And by choosing Allen first, they give themselves at least a shot to be back in that situation again next year where they get to choose. Otherwise, they option Allen and then they go into next year and now Allen has no options. And Cantillo has no options. They burned an option on Messick. And now you don't have a choice. And if at some point Ciccone needs to be optioned, now you burned his last option. You start to paint yourself into difficult roster situations when you don't pay attention to those kinds of things. And it makes sense to me not to do that. And that's why I think Messick is likely to start in the minors. I'm okay with that. All right. I thought we would get through the rest of the questions. As always, I was wrong. We still have five or six left. A lot of these are about sleepers, and I think we can cover those soon. It's probably about time to start talking that kind of stuff because we're getting up to draft season now. So with that, Pete, you got anything else to add?
I don't want to extend this episode so far, but I I was looking at
it's long enough already.
No, I was preparing for a response to the question about players who are ranked too high or ranked too low. And I just have a hair across my ass about Matt McClain. And it sounds crazy because he's going outside the top 200. But I don't get it. I just don't get it. I really don't. I understand when he first got called up and he wasn't even that high of a prospect that he was on a crazy pace that season. But I will remind people that that pace was with a BABIP of, I haven't looked at this number in a very long time, but we're of 385. And it was with a strikeout rate of 28.5%, which he increased in 2025 to 28.9%. So I didn't mean to extend this, that 47 seconds there, but like I had to just get that out about Matt McClain. He'll go 30-30 now that I said that and got that off my chest. But I just don't get it. I really don't get it.
Totally fair. I'm sort of with you. I think I see the talent with McClain, but I agree that it seems like people are more in on him than they should be still.
The BABIP was 385, by the way, during that stretch. 385 BABIP, 30% strikeout rate.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't get it. I won't have him. So draft him.
Not to spook you or anything, but I was talking about Roman Anthony earlier today. He also had a super high BABIP during that crazy debut season. So how do you feel about that one?
If Roman Anthony ends up like Matt McClain, I think I have to quit the show. So
and I don't think that's a good comparison. I do think like Anthony ran a 27% strikeout rate, 27.7, which is higher than you would like, but it is not what McClain was doing. He did have a 404 BABIP. I do think that at some level people are a little out over their skis on what Anthony already is, because he was so good, but how good he was a little inflated by that BABIP, just a little. And so I think that we're due for some regression there, but I don't actually think he's Matt McClain. I was just having some fun, but I think that's enough. I think if we reach the point where we have to clarify that Matt McClain and Roman Anthony are not the same player,
we've reached the point where we need to stop. Yeah.
So thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back with you in another week or two.